With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm going bleach blonde, aren't I? It's Monday, which means it's time for the Front Three Weekend Review with me, Adam Bolt, with the one and only Lawrence McKenna.
Yay.
Chris Ennage.
Evening.
And Mr. Marathon himself. Statman Dave.
What you meant to say is Michael Marathon.
Michael,
that's what you can call me from now on.
Marathon. Dave, you have completed a marathon. Congratulations. I'm impressed. This is a massive achievement.
Thank you.
How was it? The Paris Marathon? Did you get a decent time? Did you get the time you wanted? Was it a struggle? What are we talking about?
The time was all right. I got 5 hours and 30 minutes. It was okay.
Is that good?
I struggled in the last... It's average. It's pretty average. It was just hot. 24 degrees.
That's hot.
I'm used to running in like 5 degrees in England. so it took it out of me. But I trained up to 14 miles because I've got a bit of a knee injury at the moment. So I pretty much ran 12 miles more than my personal best ever.
Wow.
And completed it, but it was warm, but it was a good achievement, and I Snapchatted it, and the Snapchat really took me away from the pain.
It was quite funny,
like the last sort of like from kilometer 30 to 40, I was Snapchatting like the top 16 in the Premier League who they should sign in the summer. Honestly, between the kilometers, that would take my mind off the pain. It was excellent.
Oh dear. So was it more of a? It was more of a mental challenge to get over the physical hurdle. Mentally,
yeah, I think it wasn't, and there were some pretty, you know, in the marathon people fall over and get hurt, and there were some not nice scenes in a way, like running from like the Eiffel Tower was on 28 kilometers, which is a good way, and that's over half obviously out of a 42 run, but there were people that started to drop then, and I kind of passed a guy that had literally probably dropped maybe 3-4 minutes before I got there. And he was getting like CPR by other runners who were obviously doctors. And it was just that refreshing moment that you're like, I'm doing this, but I don't want to die. And from that time, I sort of slowed down. And then I was like, you know, there is more important things to life than conquering your goals. And it's, in a way, it's a life lesson. I've accomplished something that I've always wanted to accomplish. You know, if I want to do it quicker, I want to be able to train up to the full thing. But it's one of those things where your health is more important than anything in the world, and then your family is very important as well. Big shout out to the girlfriend and my sister and all the people that support on the day. You know, great support. After I finished the marathon, I felt terrible. I got a bit of sunstroke the day before from just chilling in Paris, you know, seeing the sights. And then obviously the day of the race, 24 degrees, running in pretty much the whole way in the heat. You know, running down the Seine, which is the river that goes through Paris. Just completely sun on you. There wasn't shade at all, and there's water every 5K. Just gets to a point where it's a little bit too warm. But, you know, thanks to everyone that supported me.
Dave, congratulations. Beautiful achievement. Sounds like you're taking some beautiful things from it as well. So well done. Are you going to do another one, you say?
I don't know. Maybe. I actually need to get this knee sorted, because that's the only reason I had to take ibuprofen on mile one. Pretty much doped my way around the Paris Marathon.
Dear.
Let's be honest. I'm a doper.
Yeah, basically. Basically, you cheated. You're Lance Armstrong in disguise.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well done, Dave. Do go and check out. Is your Snapchat story, if you upload that on YouTube or Facebook, people can go and check that out, because I enjoyed that very much.
It was on Snapchat, that's Statman underscore Dave, but now it's on Facebook.
Yeah,
it disappears, so I put it on Facebook. Probably going to stick more stuff on Facebook from Snapchat, just so it's, you know, you can see it if you miss it.
It's the future, right? Yeah. This Facebook lock. Anyway, guys, let's get on with the podcast. Part one is going to be, as always, the Premier League review. A seismic weekend in the English top flight, I'm sure you'll all agree. Part two, we'll also be talking to journalist Ewan McTeer about La Liga. Very interesting weekend in Spain as well. Before in part three, previewing all this week's massive Champions League action. But Lawrence, there's only one place to start, and that is with poor, pitiless, pathetic Arsenal beaten 3-0 by Crystal Palace tonight. A convincing win for Big Sam.
They did get Allardyced. It was almost a classic. No, they got Allardyced. It was almost a classic Sam Allardyce performance, actually. You know, although it would have been better if Benteke had gone in that combination, but still, Benteke was there. Kabay with the best goal of the game, and the one that sort of put the shockers on Arsenal.
Was it on purpose? I thought maybe the slip on Kabay might have just given it an extra lift, an extra loop.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't look like he was trying to cross it. So ultimately, he got the connection, which put it in the net. I'm not sure if he would have. I mean, obviously, he wanted it
benefit
to go that way.
Doubt. Yeah, let's say beautiful.
I'm not sure he intended for it to go that way. And then the penalty is the most contentious thing, because he was going down. Townsend was going down before the goalkeeper touched him, and he went for that connection. So I personally don't consider that a penalty. I know why the referee would have been bought into that, but it wasn't a penalty. Sorry.
I think I'd agree. I think I'd agree it wasn't a penalty, but overall, I think it was a very, very strong performance from Crystal Palace, Chris. Strong in defence, a clear desire to win. I mean, they were basically everything Arsenal won.
100%. And the problem is that Theo Walcott's come out and just said after the game that he thinks the Palace players wanted it more than they did. Now, again, that's perhaps not the deepest form of analysis that maybe people are looking for, but it's a pretty damning indictment on that squad and where it's at mentally, if nothing else. I think you can sit and deconstruct players and their professionalism in the modern game for as long as you want. It's fine. It doesn't change the fact that it seems now, looking at it, that they're down tools. Whether that's for Wenger or not, I think is a digression for another time, perhaps. But it highlights the fact there's something fundamentally wrong at that football club right now.
It's hard to disagree with that one, isn't it, Dave? Because the stat during the round at half-time was that Arsenal have failed to come back from a losing position away from home since September 2015. And you never really believed, with the performance they gave on the pitch, that there was any way they were going to do it tonight.
It's an interesting one, that stat. Obviously, it is winning from a losing position, but you think about the games this season, you know, the game against Manchester United, where they kind of grabbed a point out of nothing. You know, there's probably other performances like that, similar to this Arsenal season. But for me, it's just interesting what Wenger started to do with his side. You know, playing Sanchez through the middle was a masterstroke. I was calling for it all of last season. I got, you know, called all sorts of names on people in the comments on TFR, you're an idiot, you're this, you're that. You see in this season, what, 19 goals in the Premier League and 8 assists playing through the middle as a striker. You know, the majority of those goals coming from him playing as a striker. Now, again, Wenger's moved him out to the left wing. He's playing Welbeck as a central striker. Giroud's not playing. You know, the thing with Mesut Ozil, he's an elite crosser in terms of his chance creation. And he does better when there's a target man on the pitch, whether it's Ronaldo at Real Madrid from a wide position or it's someone like Olivier Giroud. Go back to the season when he registered 19 assists in the league. The highest combination of him assisting to a player was Ozil to Giroud. It's one of those things where Wenger's now not using Sanchez and he's not using Giroud, which evidently is not getting the best out of Mesut Ozil. And it's one of these things where now Wenger is, I don't know what's happening. Players like Xhaka's getting too much of the ball, someone that you generally don't want on the ball, too square, too deep in midfield. But again, he's not linking with Mesut Ozil. It's one of these things that it just seems like Wenger is getting it all wrong right now. It's just getting worse and worse for him. The 10-2 against Bayern, it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
Looks like that contract announcement, Lawrence, will have to wait another week. Maybe it'll never come at all. I mean, we've been talking recently about how the Arsenal fans are divided. They don't seem very divided tonight.
I mean, I feel basically they've played it terribly. It's the worst PR idea of all time. But part of the problem also comes from the fact that people keep talking about, well, you know, we deserve to know, which they do. But I mean, I don't know. There's a horrible sense that the club is divided, and it wouldn't be divided if it wasn't for the future of Arsene Wenger. A lot of people say, well, the future relies on Arsene Wenger. I'd argue that the club shouldn't have built their future around that. And a few years ago, it felt all right. It felt okay to say, you know, Wenger helped build this, because it was like, look, we'll build him up. He'll go for a big out and then we can move on. But that never came. And now it just feels like it's gone a little bit too far. You know, that leaves it as the frustrating thing, because not only that, but it seems as if the players are talking. The players aren't talking in a particularly committed way either way. Ozil saying, "We need if Wenger stays, then essentially he's saying, if, you know, if Wenger stays, then I'll stay too." But he's also saying, "But we need better signings. We need more new faces," which sort of said something about the current team, which apparently was ready to win the league at the end of the season, at the beginning of the season. So there's so many mixed messages coming out of Arsenal right now. It doesn't seem like they have much of a direction from a guy who's supposed to be the leader.
I just can't help but feel with Wenger, and I've said it before, that now is the time for him to step down. I just think it is an unedifying way for him to end his Arsenal career, and I find it hard to believe that he will see this as an acceptable end to his Arsenal career. You know, potentially now finishing outside the top four for the first time in Arsene Wenger's tenure, potentially even finishing below Spurs, Chris. It's hard to see Arsene Wenger accepting that as the end for him at this club that he clearly loves so dearly.
Yeah, and then I do wonder if that's part of the problem with Arsenal, is that for so long, and look, Wenger's a huge proponent of this, they've been defined by finishing in the top four. I'm not saying that fans haven't wanted to win trophies at all. It's the fact that the narrative from the manager has been, actually, as long as we get into the Champions League, that is a success. You have to think that that's really not the case at all. And I can't think of many, if any, of the big clubs in England, at least, that have looked at it through that perspective, that to make it simply into the Champions League is a big improvement. Leicester are an outlier in that, because they had never been in the Champions League, whereas Manchester United, Man City, Liverpool, etc. For them, yes, they want to finish within the top four, but that's almost the bare minimum. Whereas with Arsenal, for a number of years now, that's felt like a midpoint, if not something that is something to be admired. I'm not sure if it is, given the resources they have. That's the problem. Even the notion of them being quite parsimonious in the transfer market is starting to fall down, because they spent $35 million on Granit Xhaka. And we can debate the merits of his signing and whether he's a good player or not another time. It does prove that they aren't the poor shoppers that maybe they were 5-6 years ago. And even then, they've still bought marquee players. They've still put signings, spent more than Bayern Munich, for comparison's sake.
Well, Jamie Carragher, let me tell you, he has been going in. I believe the term the kids use is ham. Is that what they say? He's going in ham. Anyway, he has been really, really tearing into the Arsenal players, calling them cowards. You know, describing how they've been ducking out of challenges, saying that Graham Souness's description of them as a team of son-in-laws, whatever that means, was incredibly accurate. I mean, what do you make, Chris?
Because he sort of means dig at his son-in-law.
He clearly doesn't like his own son-in-law. That much is clear.
I think what he means there is a team of people who promise so much and yet deliver so little.
Who, like Carragher says. Carragher says, but what? They're a team of son-in-laws, but what father would want his daughter to bring one of them home? Hey, you know. So, Chris, you know, we're talking a lot about Arsene Wenger here and how he's responsible for the deep malaise at the club. But what about the players? Do they not need to shoulder some of this responsibility? As you said, Theo Walcott there saying that the Palace players wanted it more.
Definitely shouldered some of the responsibility, especially when he's coming out and saying that, because I'd never buy this idea that you can just blame a manager and put all the responsibility on them. There's a personal pride element. There's an individual standard that you set for yourself. You know, if
if you know you can run and all that kind of stuff, they're all intangibles that are defined by the individual. And I think the problem is there are a number of players at that football club who have fairly low standards. And I think the other issue underlying that, and I've said this previously, I feel like sometimes when a new player arrives at that club, the malaise that you referenced there does kind of seep into them a little bit and their own standards drop. And it does seem to carry over and over. There's really not, if you look at that squad, I would say there's not a multitude of winners in there. There's a few, definitely. But I would also say there's not a great number of leaders either. And I think that's another issue, is that when things are going difficult, when maybe decisions aren't going their way, there's a lot of people who do just chuck the towel in there. There's a lot of people who do accept that defeat much easier than they should. And look, I think it's not one without the other in that respect. I think Wenger has to take the blame, because I would say he's not only recruited some of these people, but he's also set them up in a position where they're not winning, and they're clearly not playing in the best possible system or formation, whichever way you look at it. And vice versa, those players clearly aren't fit to wear the shirt, as some have alluded to.
Yeah, as the fans were keen on telling him. Even Media Lovey, as he's been described by Arsenal Fan TV before, John Cross, calling for Wenger's head tonight, saying that he shouldn't be given a contract extension. So maybe it's all over if even John Cross is on the Wenger out bandwagon.
It was going to go wrong when Paul Merson said, I don't see why they can't string seven games together.
True, very true. On the other hand, Lawrence, big win for Big Sam. Now 6 points clear of the relegation zone.
It's looking better than some other sides down there. It's still going to get some better performances in the final few games. I mean, they've still got a tricky run. The thing for me is I was also impressed with the fact that, again, Arsenal seem to be just so transparent in the way that they play their tactics that another side can just go, okay, cool, well, we'll just do the normal things we do and then we'll beat them 3-0. Even with the deficiencies that Crystal Palace showed tonight, which arguably Saka had his worst game in a Palace shirt so far, they still managed to get very little past them. Inadvertently, Saka, I suppose, has helped Liverpool. A bird in the hand is worth two Sakos in the Crystal Palace team.
There's going to be a variation of that every episode now, isn't there?
I just think it's worth calling at least one podcast something like, you know, a bird in the podcast is worth two in the iTunes or something. Liverpool started to play Crystal Palace.
So does Spurs.
Tottenham still have to play Crystal Palace. Man City still have to play Crystal Palace. And Manchester United still have to play Crystal Palace. So there's a lot of big teams there that Big Sam can try and outdo. And you sort of think it's either the perfect run for him or it's the worst run for him. He's going to have to take 12 points from those final few games in order to keep them up, I think.
I think he's safe now. I really do. I think it's between Hull and Swansea. Swansea have massively dropped off a cliff. And Hull, I think, have sort of little peaks and valleys with Silva, where it goes right, and then other times where I think he maybe is a little bit naive to the lack of quality he's got, or something along those lines. So, honestly, I think Palace are safe, though. I think.
Yeah, it's 6 points, isn't it? It's probably more than sufficient cap.
It is now. I haven't got to that magic 40 yet, but I'm sure Big Sam will.
A great man did tell us, though, Big Sam does get things good around April time, ain't that right, Lawrence?
Yeah, Big Sam did tell us that, yeah.
And plus, Swansea are on what, 28? So you've got a bank on Swansea getting four wins at least. That's a big ask.
Optimistic, potentially.
I'm an optimist in Wales. I just want Wales to have representation.
Let's move on to Manchester United, Dave. Beating Sunderland comfortably. 3-0 in the end. Ibrahimovic scoring the opener, of course, which means I've been contemplating how I'll look with bleach blonde hair all weekend. I think it's just three goals left, until I'm actually going to have to take the plunge. But regardless, comfortable win. Even Luke Shaw had a good game. Got a pat on the back, Dave.
I think it's the nuances of the system. Mourinho likes to defend with three players at the back. If they've got one attacking fullback, the other fullback tucks in. Think of Aspilicueta recently at Chelsea, and you go back to any of his teams, there's always a player that holds. You know, go back to his first team at Chelsea, William Gallas was playing on one side, Glenn Johnson was playing on the other side. You go to, let's say, Inter Milan, Chievo was playing on the as left back, Maicon was the best right fullback in world football. That's what Mourinho does, and unfortunately, that's kind of it's killing United a little bit in attack. They're a little bit one-sided, either if they do go down the left or they do go down the right with their fullbacks. You know, the ideal situation they should go to is playing a 3-4-3, but that's very un-Mourinho. He's played it a few times this season, but I'd like him to play it a bit more, but he's not done it in recent weeks. But in terms of what Luke Shaw did, he was very good in the game, grabbed a good assist. You know, people saying, oh, that was an assist. It was a cracking pass from left fullback in between the opposition's right back and right centre back. Mkhitaryan, yes, had a wonderful touch. Yes, there could have been some better work from the Sunderland defence, but it was a very good finish, a very good ball from Luke Shaw. But a fantastic game, and it allowed him to go forward playing Darmian as a right back. So it's that kind of like the swing of the back four, let's say, that Luke Shaw can advance if Antonio Valencia is not playing on the side. Unfortunately, Antonio Valencia is in the form of his life right now. So it's one of these things where Luke Shaw will get games, but will he show enough for Mourinho not to sell him the summer? It's still on. It's still on. Whether it's going to happen or not, I don't know.
As for Sunderland, Chris, David Moyes up against his former club, somewhat illustrating how far his stock has fallen. Rock bottom of the table, bad weekend all told. If it wasn't bad enough, he's now accused of verbally abusing a second female reporter. Is emerged tonight. Footage emerging of him.
Too many of them in the game, mate.
Aiming a rant at Jackie Oley this time.
Not our Jackie.
Not a great couple of days for
not our Jackie.
For David.
No, but then that's the thing. He's a real vacuum for confidence in that sense. He genuinely sucks the air out of a room. He's a coach that I think is not very tactically astute, and then he supplements that with a really poor media handling style. So the comparison I would draw is Martin O'Neill, who I don't think is the most tactically complex manager at present in the game. Yet, and I've said this before on the podcast, if there was one thing I always noticed about O'Neill, not only could he read a room very well, but he could also really cover up a situation with a well-timed quip or a remark or shift the focus onto something more positive. And the same applies to the likes of, to lesser degrees, Allardyce, Poirier, Di Canio. They all had their own flaws, of course, but even with those three, and I point more specifically to Poirier and Di Canio, you at least felt some of them were going to try. Whereas you look at this current team and you think they're gone now. They are relegated now, and there's no optimism in that city right now towards the running. Whereas usually there's this sort of belief that if we dig in, if we try, then there's a chance we can stay up and pull off another great escape. But Moyes has completely eradicated that because he doesn't know how to inspire confidence. And it's really just poor showing. That's the thing as well, is I speak to Sunderland fans on a fairly regular basis, obviously given where I live. None of them want him next season. Not one of them want him to stay on board. And I think at this point, they're less sick of the situation they're in, because actually it might be a little bit of sweet relief from the usual arduous Premier League campaign, and then getting rid of him because they don't think he'll give them that sort of fresh start, if you will, or that rebuild that the club so desperately needs.
Is it hard for you to believe, Dave, that this man was Manchester United manager just a few short seasons ago? Does it all seem like a bad dream?
I think the thing with David Moyes is he's just become outdated with his methods. Unfortunately, the game's moved on and David Moyes hasn't moved with the game. You know, he's won the LMA Manager of the Year award three times. He's not a bad manager, but he's not a good manager now. In the past, he was a very good manager. What he did with that Everton team was extraordinary. It was brilliant. It's like what Poch is doing at Spurs. It was that good about getting the amount of wages that they spent in that side and outperforming the competitors around them. But what he's doing now is he hasn't moved his game on. It's still that style of football that worked maybe 5 years ago. Similar to what Chris was saying about Martin O'Neill. Martin O'Neill's Villa side played a wonderful counter-attacking defensive system. But right now, that wouldn't work in the Premier League because the game's developed further. The game's developed to this counter-pressing, the pressing, using the ball in different ways, using fullbacks in central midfield and so forth. The game's moved on, but these managers like David Moyes haven't moved on. And you kind of saw with United as they as the game went on, you know, not, then United had the advantage of the man after the sending off, which I'd like to get your guys' opinions on that in a second. But firstly, United, they just broke. They counterattacked so well against David Moyes' side, and David Moyes didn't have any solution to break down Manchester United's deep block. And unfortunately, that was a problem at Manchester United. So it's one of these things. But that tackle, what do you think? Is it a sending off? Is it a red card?
I thought it was reckless when I saw it. Like I said, I was at the game, and when he did it, purely the angle of his foot, the leading foot, made me think, I think he's going to get sent off here.
It's a real weird one. It seems like it's... The first time I saw it, I honestly thought it was a nothing tackle. You know, he's sliding in, but then obviously the replay from behind him, he is going in, studs up, and it is like in a, you know, it's the Seamus Coleman angle, which is obviously not good for a player to do, and hence why referees may have been, you know, spotting those types of things and sending players off. But it's an interesting one. Should it have been a red card? I just don't know. I really don't know. I think it's in a really grey area right now where potentially the laws may need to be adapted for the safety of the players.
Oh, someone's been talking to Nico and Napoon. It's not the first... I'm joking. It's not the first time, though, that we've seen Larsson display this sort of behaviour. And I'm fighting the urge to sort of go down the route of he is this type of player.
Like Ross Barkley?
Snide, I believe, is the word you're looking for.
I think it would be best to say under pressure situations... I don't think Larsson copes particularly well. And I've heard that that's a few of the reasons why he's never been picked by one of the top clubs to sort of take to the next level.
I mean, look, that's the thing. Intent's a funny one because on the one hand, there are a lot of people that say he's not that type of player, is not mitigation for an action.
I don't even mean that. I just mean he tends to lose his head and do silly things.
Yes.
I don't necessarily mean that he meant it. I don't. Yeah.
I think that's a fair comment. The other thing I think as well is even before the sending off, when it was 11v11, I didn't really see how some of them were going to score other than lumping it in the box or maybe a corner going wrong from a Manchester United perspective. For the most part, they were fairly comfortable. As soon as Sunderland got the ball out of defence and into midfield, the team's arse just dropped, for want of a better phrase.
What's the best way? I mean, how long do you give a manager until you think he can turn it round? Because the problem is that David Moyes has been giving the exact same interview, the exact same depressing interview since the beginning of the season. Even pre-season, he was like, it's going to be a struggle. It's going to be awful. And you sort of look at that squad and think, David...
I mean, look, he said earlier in the season, if he'd known the club's financial status, he might not have taken the job. That's just the worst thing in the world to say from a motivational perspective. And that's the thing, whether it's what he said to Vicky Sparks, Jackie Oatley, he just seems to consistently misjudge a room. And I've never known anything like it. And look, there's people who have said, I believe I'm paraphrasing Andy Tate here, he got the job in a technicality or something like that. He essentially was elevated to the position of Manchester United because Sir Alex Ferguson made a mistake, which, again, he's not infallible, Sir Alex. He made mistakes when it came to signing players, so it's fairly rational that he could do the same with a coaching selection. And you look after that with Real Sociedad, you look at Sunderland now, there's nothing in there to make me think he's the right man for that club at all. I've put out there already, if Huddersfield don't go up, I would go straight for David Wagner and say, here's 10, 15 million.
Yeah.
You know, start next week. You can reshape the squad. Because he's actually taken a group of, with all due respect to most of them, bar maybe one or two average players, and got them third place, a mere 10 points behind Brighton and Newcastle, who've spent mountains more than they have.
I've got to admit that I do also wonder whether Wagner might have his sights set on something a little bit higher, whether some people a little bit higher might have their sights set on him.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. I think he's done enough this season. It's funny, but I can imagine he's desperate to kind of separate himself from Klopp a little bit because they are obviously so close off the pitch that it's natural to compare them on it. I do think he has that same flaw, tactically at least, in that the flexibility isn't always really there. And if the intensity that he applies to the the game when they're leading play Huddersfield doesn't work. He doesn't really know what to do. I mean, he set them up earlier in the season to be a very good counter-attacking team, and he showed some tactical flexibility. But when it's not working plan A, then, I mean, I watched them against Forest at the weekend. They were undone really easily and should have been beaten probably 3 or 4-0 at the end of things, but managed to get away with, I think, a 2-0 result at the end.
Let's move on to Everton's 4-2 win over Leicester. A seventh straight home win for Everton against Leicester side, resting a few players ahead of their Champions League midweek tie against Atletico Madrid, of course. Romelu Lukaku, though, taking the headlines, Chris, after scoring 2. Now the league's top scorer on 23. Predictably, all the talk of whether Everton can keep a player this good, Chris. Ronald Koeman suggesting afterwards that there is a contract on the table.
Romelu Lukaku.
We should start that bit again.
No, can you imagine if he changed his name to try and get him to like him? Romelu Lukaku.
Ronald Koeman suggesting after the game there's a contract on the table just waiting to be signed, Chris.
I would imagine there is. That makes complete sense. He's a key component of that team. I have a sneaking suspicion, though, that he will set his sights a bit like Mr. Wagner, a little bit higher in the league. And look, that's not me taking swipes at Everton. I just think they're at a much earlier stage in their project. And the merits of should he wait? Does he owe them something because they took the risk? I think they're all inconsequential at this point. There's a chance to make a massive sum on him. And I think they could possibly learn a lesson from Sunderland and what they did with Lamine Kone, which was, they hung on to him. Sunderland offered him a new contract and turned down the 20 million. If you tried to sell him tomorrow, you would be lucky to get half that, really. And I think Lukaku is a lot more consistent and will likely grow a little bit more. I just think you could do a lot more with that money. That's the thing. It's not something they need, obviously, because of the owner. I just think that when you're trying to keep a player who really isn't settled, really isn't happy, you've got to think what that will do to the rest of them in that dressing room. That's the other concern, is whether it's a necessity for the money or not, his attitude will permeate out to the rest of the squad.
Well, that's the worry, isn't it, Dave? Because as well as Romelu Lukaku, Koeman also said similar things about Ross Barkley, who, we'll say he had a mixed weekend at best. But Koeman as well saying that, you know, maybe he should be sold. His contract's running out at the end of next season. If he doesn't sign a new contract that's on offer as well, if two players of that influence leave, it could be a problem for the Toffees.
Honestly, I think Ross Barkley should leave Everton. I think he needs to go somewhere else to take in some other football culture. Yeah, he's having a wonderful season this season, but still hot and cold. It's still very narrow-minded in the penalty area, very narrow-minded around the penalty area and what he wants to do. He needs to open himself up a little bit more, think a little bit more. He's too much of a, you know, going on his heart, not going with his brain at the moment as an attacking midfielder. And honestly, moving somewhere else would give him, you know, would do him the world of good, getting out of his comfort zone and playing for somebody else. Maybe going abroad would be perfect, but is Ross Barkley going to adopt another language? Is he going to adopt another style of football and so forth? Is another question. But I just think Ross Barkley needs to leave. He's 23 years old now. He's not made his break at Everton. He's not moved to Manchester United, to Chelsea, to Manchester City. He needs to go. He just needs to go and spread his wings elsewhere. And if Koeman, knew will be at Everton for the next few seasons, ain't getting the Barca job, is going to be hammering him week after week. Maybe it's time for him to go. Similar to the Luke Shaw situation at Manchester United. If it doesn't work for Luke Shaw this season, needs to leave.
Wow.
Tough words from Statman Dave. Leicester, though, Lawrence. Craig Shakespeare's winning run coming to an end. Some interesting comments, though, from Claudio Ranieri, who was the guest on this week's Monday Night Football, suggesting that it wasn't the players that pushed him out of the club, but maybe someone behind him, directly behind him. Who could he be referring to?
Maybe he's got some ghosts in his life.
Maybe.
Genuinely, Claudio Ranieri was supposed to leave. I mean, it was just, when he says pushed, he means someone who didn't help me and then sort of turned on me.
Mm. His exact quote was, "I can't believe my players killed me. No, no, no. Maybe it was someone behind me. I had a little problem the year before and we won the title. Maybe this year, when we lose, these people push a little more, eh?
I think you're doing him a disservice here, I must confess.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think, look, Ranieri does not speak fluent English. If you watch the segment with Monday Night Football, yeah, I think it's taken too literally. But
he's clearly trying to.
I think the point I'm trying to make is I'm very cautious of taking every word that he says literally. I think, look, he was given the chance to say who they were, which was so just slimy the way he was asked, do you want to say who those people are? But regardless, I'm just a little bit skeptical if he meant Shakespeare in that context. I think
who else do you think he meant? Yeah.
Could have been the owners, could have been anybody.
It's just clear he wanted to hint at someone. Well, not even hint, he wanted to suggest someone was behind his dismissal.
Well, no, that's the thing. They gave him the chance. They said, do you want to tell us who they are? And he said, no, it's...
But he was happy enough to suggest there was someone there. Maybe not. He said, you know, I'm a law man. I don't want to say exactly who it was, but it was someone.
That's the dignified approach of him, to be fair. I'm a big fan, full disclosure, I'm a big fan of Claudio Ranieri.
Yeah, who isn't?
And I think he can answer the question truthfully, which is to say, look, I think someone did push for it. But then he doesn't have to say, I think it was person X or person Y. And I think actually that's probably the right side of the line when it comes to that sort of thing, because it is airing your opinion, but it's also not causing needless controversy or, you know, alleging guilt without any real certainty about a situation. I think it's just a very dignified approach from him.
Let's talk about Liverpool, Lawrence. A 2-1 win for them in the end, away from home, Stoke. Hard-fought victory. Talk of a big gamble from Jurgen Klopp with his starting 11. A gamble that almost backfired. But the super subs saved them, Lawrence. Perhaps exposing the lack of depth in the squad at Anfield?
Surely the lack of depth means that it wasn't such a gamble. It would have been... start Coutinho, maybe we would have seen a different... shaped the game. I think, you know, people thought it was brave or whatever you want to call it. He started Trent Alexander-Arnold and Woodburn. Woodburn actually looked very, very good going forward, brought the ball together quite nicely in the attack. So sort of gave them a nice point to play through up towards the strikers for Liverpool. And I guess the Liverpool fans all sort of say, well, you know, we didn't start our two most creative players in the side. And then when they did come on, it was a great boost, one of which he didn't feel was good enough to play 90 or sort of 100%, which was Firmino. And the other was Coutinho, who apparently was ill just hours before, but sort of deemed himself ready. So I think it worked out quite nicely. But ultimately, again, it sort of shows without certain players, Liverpool do look fairly blunted. So either it's going to have to be a lot of changes or Liverpool are really going to have to bring up a lot of players from the youth team in the summer. A youth team which will be then very threadbare because, they may have a ban because of tapping up certain players elsewhere in the league.
Let's talk Tottenham, guys. A 4-0 win over Watford. Four-star performance, I believe they call that. Fantastic win for Spurs. All the talk, though, Dave, about one man and one man only. Dele Alli opening the scoring with a superb goal, curling it in to that top corner. Lots of comparisons being made. A lot of hyperbole, I think it's fair to say. He's better than Scholes, Gerrard and Beckham put together, was the headline on the BBC. Twisted the stats somewhat. But a lot of comparisons to some of the greats from the English game. He is 21 tomorrow on Tuesday. We do have to remind ourselves, on course potentially to win the PFA Young Player of the Year for a second year in a row. And he could potentially win it 4 years in a row. He's still going to be eligible, believe it or not, in the 2018-19 season.
We've got early.
Yeah.
Dele Alli. I just don't think it's a terrible song. But in terms of his player, real quality. But he's not really a midfielder and shouldn't be compared with midfielders. He's more of a striker or a second striker. You know, he's done so well at arriving late into the penalty area and putting the ball into the back of net.
it's quite a unique finisher in a way of how he just sort of, you know, catches it at the last moment and it'll go in. But that goal he scored against Watford at the weekend was excellent, coming onto his right foot from the left-hand side. In terms of goals this season, he scored more than Eden Hazard, Neymar and Antoine Griezmann in the league, which is pretty incredible for a 20-year-old. And of course, the top scorer of players under 21 in Europe's top five leagues. Pochettino's getting the best out of him. You know, he's saving Tottenham when Harry Kane's out as well. So it's one of these things where this player could become one of the greats. But you look at the players that you mentioned before, Gerrard, Scholes and Lampard, they're the best midfielders that we've, English midfielders we've ever seen. Dele Alli, could he be there? Potentially. At the moment, he's starting off similar to what Paul Scholes did, playing as an attacking midfielder, almost as a striker, scoring a lot of goals from late runs from deep. But it is about his maturity and how he evolves his game is going to be a big one. When he loses his pace, can he continue his game? Because a lot of attacking midfielders that play a similar position to that, go back to the great Kaká, as soon as his pace went, his game went. And that is it could be a problem for Dele Alli.
I think it's interesting, as you say, the comparisons there, maybe not completely accurate in that they're players in different positions, different roles, different purposes in their team. But I think it does illustrate to an extent, you know, how promising this guy is at that age to be producing that amount of goals, 16 this season, and being that decisive in these games with his overall contribution. As you said, with Harry Kane out now for three games, he stepped up. He's sort of taken the mantle and taken on that burden, that goal-scoring burden.
It's worth noting he switched up from central midfield as well, because I was fortunate enough to see him when he was at MK Dons in person. They played a cup tie up at Sunderland, and the biggest compliment I can give him is that I didn't realise how young he was until sort of after the game when Carl Robinson said, I think you're going to be writing a lot about this boy in the years to come. And it was one of those things where you kind of stop and think, holy crap, he was like 17 at that point. Yeah. And not only did he look as good as the Premier League midfielders he was against, but I'd argue actually looked better for large portions of that game. So it's no surprise to see him do that. I think the fact that he's moved up to that position that Dave talks about as well as a sort of second striker is quite impressive, because it's really not as easy a position as people want to think.
No, is it
all about timing? I think it's difficult to have that and give that. You know, when he's got the acceleration right now, what I mentioned before, but he's using that so well. He's getting into the box at the right time, and it's very impressive for a 20-year-old. I think that's the most impressive thing, that he's mature. It took Antoine Griezmann till he was 25 to really get the knack of appearing in the box at the right time. Dele Alli's doing it, what, 18, 19, 20? Incredible talent.
I think the best thing is as well that at the age he's at, he is going to develop into an even more complete player. And we've potentially only just seen the beginning of how good Dele Alli can be. And I think at Spurs, with especially Mauricio Pochettino there, he's got the perfect environment really to realise his potential to its fullest. You know, there's a lot of talk about him potentially going to Real Madrid, maybe Manchester United. I don't see why it would serve Dele Alli to go to those clubs when he's in the perfect situation now to take his talents to the next level. And credit to Pochettino, you're talking about the position there. Pochettino's found the way to accommodate Dele Alli and get the best out of him. And it was interesting to hear Pochettino speak after the game of how he and Alli have a sort of father-son relationship. You know, he's clearly trying hard off the pitch to get the best out of this player. He appreciates that he's a young talent that perhaps sometimes needs an arm around the shoulder. It's something he spoke about, despite the sort of discipline issues that Dele Alli has had now and again. That he feels that Dele Alli needs to be encouraged. You know, he was talking about how Dele Alli has a quality where to lose on the pitch, Dele Alli feels like, you know, it's as bad as losing one's life. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that's how Pochettino seemed to describe it. He's obviously trying to harness that and trying to transform it into a positive impact on the game and take that desire and channel it in the right direction for Dele Alli. So I thought it's interesting for Pochettino to speak so warmly about Alli after the game, and I couldn't help but draw comparisons in my mind to perhaps the way Jose Mourinho had talked about Luke Shaw earlier in the week, to see the difference between the way the two potentially approach young players and the development of young players. But either way, future's looking bright for Dele Alli. Future's looking bright for Spurs as well. Still in second, consolidating that position, looking good to finish there, and potentially, as I mentioned earlier, finish above Arsenal for the first time in 22 years. Elsewhere this weekend, West Brom losing 1-0 to Southampton, leaving both teams somewhat stranded in mid-table, Lawrence, somewhat stranded in Premier League purgatory, if you will, particularly Tony Pulis. Going towards this, the run-in in the Premier League, West Brom last season failed to win any of the last 9 league games. You know, once they hit that magic 40-point mark, that was it for them. This season, 3 games into those final 9 games, they've now suffered 2 defeats and 1 draw. We could be seeing a repeat of that once again. Like I said, he's hit the 40-point mark. In fact, in the full 6 campaigns he's managed in the Premier League, he's hit an average of 45 points. Very consistent, and I think it's fair to say, you know, if they do indeed finish 8th this season, West Brom, that is an achievement. But next season, should that be the limit of their ambition under Tony Pulis? Can he aim higher with this team? Or do you think this may be his ceiling?
I think ceiling is maybe a little bit unfair. I think he's probably set targets, and every time he realizes he's hit that target, it isn't flip-flops, but at the same time, you think there are elements of this team where you think he begins to experiment, he begins to say, well, what can we try with this side? And I think he begins to test out what they could do next season, or what they could do if they want to play a little bit looser. And I just don't think it works very often. It's a difference in training, it's a difference in regime. And from the way that it looks, I think a lot of sides take advantage of that. Or at the same time, they also tend to play sides who actually need points come the end of the season. So if you just leave yourself there and Pulis knows he can put his feet up, you probably got a group of players who aren't quite in the place to win a game.
I feel like, Chris, they're, you know, maybe West Brom, maybe Stoke as well, although they're sort of drifting towards danger. Some of these teams seem to be caught in this mid-table purgatory where, you know, they're perhaps too good to go down, but not good enough to challenge for, say, the Champions League. I mean, maybe the Europa League is the most they can hope for. 7th position looks like it will achieve qualification for the Europa League this season. But yeah, is that even a reward? Is that something they want to push for when we've seen the impact it has upon sides who struggle to juggle both, you know, domestic and European competition?
Well, that's the thing. I look at someone like Mark Hughes at Stoke City, and I think it fits into that sort of situation that you talk about. It's difficult because it seems like a cycle of events where you hit mid-table, so you buy new players because you think the current ones won't take you to that next level. And then it's the constant cycle of, you look at Gianni Mbula, who arrived for, I think, a club record fee and now is being talked about as someone that will likely be sold in the summer. I think it's very easy to get locked into the idea of being involved in a project too, in inverted commas, where you look at, you know, in 5 years or 3 years, this is what we aim to achieve. Realistically, it can become quite boring being in that position as well. You look at, you know, West Brom or Stoke City or someone like that, just existing in the league is actually not as fun as it sounds. And I think, well, they wouldn't want relegation, obviously. I think moving up to that next step becomes harder year on year because those already at the top have that established history of being there and also tend to have used their resources slightly better and build up a reserve as a consequence.
Would you not also say season ticket holders deserve something? You know, I mean, if you buy and consistently want to see your team perform, you don't buy a 30 or a 28 game ticket. You buy something to see them try to achieve. Now, this might be considered achievement and it might be nice to be able to sit back and relax. You know, you don't necessarily know what the fans want to get from their football. They might want, you know, that. And some people don't want to be a yo-yo club. So, you know, it is moving away from that. Maybe they're willing to be in that area. You know, it's not like West Brom have sort of dropped down from this. They're trying to build, and you'd argue this is a very solid platform. The issue would be maybe that under Pulis at this point, it looks as if squads begin to stagnate. And when that begins to happen, then you think, well, what's the best way to move forward? And it would look as if it could be getting a manager like Silva from Hull, maybe Wagner from Huddersfield, who can progress the squad in a way, and maybe build on the likes of what, you know, maybe in the same way that Everton built on what Moyes managed to do there, which was a very solid, consistent defence. And arguably, if they replaced him with someone who maybe could have combined a little better than Martinez did, then they would have climbed the table and maybe been able to attract some more talents. And it seems there are some managers in the Premier League that are able to do that. So arguably, this purgatory is more of a stage and less of a symptom.
I would be more inclined to agree if either of the coaches that we're referencing had taken the club up to that next level before.
But that's my point, is I don't think that that's necessarily Pulis's job.
So what is his job?
So
his job is to build the solid base. His job is to get them
and then be replaced, essentially.
But the problem is that I think a lot of people look to attract new managers. It's not uncommon to hear that clubs want to be bought at this point. I think it seems very clear where West Brom want to move with this team. That, you know, they're one of the only clubs that are currently representing that area of the Midlands, and so it's going to be a very lucrative prospect to move into that area. Birmingham don't look like they're coming up at any point. Aston Villa don't look like they're coming up at any point. So there's somewhat of an exciting business prospect there. I don't think it's the worst team to invest in. I just imagine that they are looking for someone to sell. The problem is we've seen a number of clubs have stagnated, and it is, you know, it's arguable that the squads also stagnate under Pulis because, I don't know whether you want to call it sort of inertia or whatever.
Purgatory, maybe the word. as we're in the Premier League this weekend, West Ham, big win for Stamford Bridge, 1-0. Over Swansea at the London Stadium, ending a 5-game losing run, leaving Swansea in the bottom three. Not looking so good for Paul Clement at the moment. About winning five now, the Swans. We also had Manchester City ending a 4-game winless run in the Premier League. A 3-1 win over Hull City for them, maintaining their gap above Manchester United. 4 points clear in fourth place. Chelsea, meanwhile, brushing aside Bournemouth by the same scoreline, 3-1, to maintain their 7-point lead at the top of the table. And finally, Middlesbrough, not doing themselves any favours, managing a goalless draw at home against Burnley, leaving them 6 points adrift of safety. Right, that's the Premier League, wrapped up, reviewed, analysed. Let's move on.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
To La Liga. So, La Liga journalist Ewan McTeer joining us now to talk all the action in Spain this weekend. Ewan, welcome back to the front three.
Thanks very much for having me. How are you?
Very well, very well. Excited to talk La Liga with you. Perhaps most significantly this weekend, Ewan, Barcelona missing out on the chance to return to the top of La Liga after they were stunned by Malaga on Saturday, losing 2-0 to leave them 3 points behind leaders Madrid, having played a game more.
Yeah, there was a good clip going around with on Catalan radio, and when Real Madrid drew in the Madrid derby, you could hear the commentators giggling away, and a few hours later they were quite silent, and it really was just a missed opportunity for Barcelona. I mean, a draw against Atletico should always be considered worthwhile, and so it proved, because Barcelona went down to Malaga, they lost, had a couple of suspensions, Piqué and Rakitic were both out, and again, when they picked up their suspensions, there was it was sort of relief because it meant they would be able to play the Clásico, but this game against Malaga was always going to be quite tricky there on the up under their new coach Michel, who really kind of responded well. They won in midweek, and yeah, they managed to keep a clean sheet against Barcelona at the Camp Nou, and they did it again, and they won 2-0. So it was a really missed opportunity for Barcelona. They played quite well in the first half. They had a few chances, and their nemesis, Carlos Kameni, in the Malaga goal thwarted them, and then Malaga took a lead. And then when Neymar got himself sent off, that kind of just took the wind out of their sails, and in truth, they never really looked like coming back once they were down to 10.
And what did you make of that red card? Obviously for two yellows, one for seemingly trying to delay the game, tying his lace, and it could mean now, with Neymar sarcastically clapping the officials as he left the pitch, could mean that he misses El Clasico in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the second yellow, I think it was a yellow, but the first one, he was, you know, planted himself right in front of a free kick, tying his laces, which is, it was a little bit harsh, but when you do that and you know where the free kick's going to be taken, and you know, you're asking for it and you're giving the referee a decision to make. And then once you're on one yellow card, you can't go charging in like that at the corner. So I think it was probably fair enough. And yeah, to clap the fourth official on the way off, I really think someone at the club should have been telling him, just get yourself off and don't miss any more than one game. Because now, again, no decision has been made at the moment, but now the Spanish FA have a decision to make. And yeah, he could well miss the Clásico. And he'd been their best player over the last month, and he'd been in better form than Messi, so that would be a massive blow considering they really now need to win that game.
Meanwhile, you mentioned it there, Antoine Griezmann rescuing a point for Atletico in the Madrid derby this weekend. 1-1 it finished at the Bernabeu.
Yeah, I mean, he was just awesome. I mean, he scored a goal, but besides that, he was superb. Simeone was saying after the game, he loves Griezmann so much because he knows he has so much talent, yet he's willing to sacrifice for himself for the team. And his average position in the game was actually in the centre circle. He was dropping back so much. And he made 8 tackles or something like that, 6 of them in his own half. He was just everywhere. And I mean, Fernando Torres was pretty, he kind of ghosted his way through the game. Kevin Gamero, the striker they signed last summer, was injured. So it was really all up to him to make something happen in attack. And, you know, he managed to get a few shots. He had this superb overhead kick, which it would have been offside if it had gone in. But yeah, he got one chance with 5 minutes to go. First time, hit it in, and yeah, he was just awesome.
I mean, you're talking about those defensive qualities, sacrificing himself for the team. Sounds something like Jose Mourinho might be a fan of. I mean, what is the latest on his future? Because, I mean, the speculation is just constant, really. And the most recent report suggesting that he could, in fact, maybe sign a new contract at Atletico Madrid.
Yeah, I think he's actually having a bit of fun with it now. He knows that everybody he's talking about his future, and after the game he was sort of saying he doesn't rule anything out, but he's happy at Atletico. He said several times that he's happy at Atletico, but you never know what the future is going to hold. And I think his future will be linked somewhat to what Diego Simeone does, and it looks like Simeone is going to be here next season, so I'd be surprised if Griezmann goes this summer. But you never really know. But he's having fun with it. A few weeks ago, he tweeted at Marca to sort of say they'd spelled his name wrong in a tweet. And he tweeted to say, you know, I've been in Spain long enough that you should know how to spell my name, but maybe you just spell my name right when we're talking about transfers. And I think everybody's having a little bit of fun with it now. And so he's almost fueling the fire with some of these post-match comments where he's not ruling out a move to Real Madrid, which I think in his head he probably knows wouldn't go too well for him. So, yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens in the summer. But I'd be surprised if he does go this season.
Sevilla, meanwhile, got back to winning ways. Their first win in 6 matches. A 4-2 victory over Deportivo La Coruña.
Yeah, I mean, they've been 6 matches it was, including the Leicester defeat, since they last won. And they kind of stuck to the Sampaoli style. They didn't really change anything, and they managed to get the big 4-2 win over Deportivo, which they beat them away earlier in the season 4-3, so you know, circle that one in red next year. So Sevilla back to winning ways, have still got to fight Atletico for third place, and I mean, that really does look like a big task, but they should, if they can pick up a few more wins between now and the end of the season, they should guarantee that fourth spot, and then at least when it comes to trying to persuade Sampaoli to stay, at least they'll have Champions League football to offer them.
What is the latest on that? Because a lot of speculation in recent weeks over his future as the title challenge for Sevilla has faltered. Talk he may leave the club. Talk that Sevilla's recent form may have cost him a shot at the Barcelona job. Talk even linking him to the Argentinian coaching role if Edgardo Bauza is dismissed. I mean, what is the latest?
Again, I don't think anything will become clearer until the summer. He's sort of spoken about with Monchi, the sporting director, leaving that he really wants some clarity in terms of what is the Sevilla project. Is Sevilla a team on the up? Is it really going to be one of these, the new Atletico Madrid that can challenge with Real Madrid or Barcelona? Or is this excellent season they've had just a flash in the pan? I think he wants some clarity in terms of what the project at the club is going to be, who's going to be coming in to replace Monchi before he decides whether he wants to stay there. And from Sevilla's point of view, none of those decisions will be made until the summer. So I think he'll have to wait until then before he decides if he's interested in sticking around or if he'll look to leave. He does have one extra year in his contract, which a lot of people seem to forget. So as it stands, he should be coaching them until the summer of 2018. But yeah, it's another tricky one to predict.
And finally, rounding up the top six, and none other than Eibar, Ewan. Now unbeaten in five, and hopes of European qualification now on for Eibar.
I know. I mean, sixth place is the final Europa League spot, but if Barcelona do defeat Alaves in the Copa del Rey final, then seventh position would also become a European spot. So they really do have a good chance. And the most interesting thing is that it's a Basque race for that final spot. The top five is, you know, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Atletico, Sevilla, Villarreal, they're all a little bit too far ahead. But then you've got Eibar, Athletic and Real Sociedad all battling for those final two or three Europa League spots. And then also hoping that their other Basque neighbour, Alaves, don't win the cup. So it looks like there's going to be some European football coming to the Basque country. We just don't quite know where it's going to be. But Eibar have put themselves in a great position, and two of those wins in the last week have been momentous ones. They beat Villarreal away from home and Celta Vigo away from home, which are two really statement wins that show that if they can beat those teams, they really could defeat anybody.
Sky's the limit. Ewan, thank you so much for coming on. Fantastic stuff. Where can the listeners find more of you?
On Twitter at E McTeer. You'll find me there.
Thanks to Ewan. Fantastic stuff, as always. An author as well. Go and check out his book, Eibar the Brave. Fantastic stuff on a fantastic team. Did I say fantastic too many times there? I'll let you be the judge. Let's talk Champions League, guys. Some very, very exciting midweek fixtures. Not least of which, Dave, on Tuesday evening, Juventus-Barcelona. We were just saying to Ewan there about Barcelona, a disappointing defeat to Malaga there at the weekend. I mean, based on the current form, despite, you know, that miraculous comeback in the Champions League, you've got the feeling that Juventus are going to win this one, Dave, no?
I think Barcelona will win the tie, but Juventus will win this first leg. I think with this Barcelona team, they're a cup team this season. I think that the league, that the form has suffered, but they can still get to that top level. You know, you think of the players in there that can reach the, if they play at the top level, you're not going to get near Andres Iniesta, you're not going to get Lionel Messi, you're not going to get near Neymar, near Messi, near Suarez.
They have these game changers, Dave, right now.
I think the thing is how do they deal without Sergio Busquets, obviously suspended for this second leg? How do they deal without Rafinha on that right-hand side? Because he's been pretty decent in this 3-5-2 or the 3-3-1-3 or the 3-4-3 or the 3-6-1, whatever you want to call it. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how Luis Enrique sets out that midfield, who comes in. Maybe Mascherano goes to defensive midfield. Maybe they bring someone like Mathieu into the back three. Whether they play a back three, there's a lot of questions. And, you know, Luis Enrique has shown in the past that he can get the best out of this side. So it'll be up to him to get them in the best position. But I still think they've got enough to win this tie, although I'm a massive fan of Juventus this season.
Intriguing, that. I've got a feeling Juventus are going to exploit. They're going to exploit Barcelona in this tie. I think they're going to win this one.
Especially if Matthew's playing. He was awful at the weekend against Malaga. Try to play an offside against Sandro Ramirez. It was just, I don't even know why he had his hand up. It was just crazy.
Lawrence, you have Barcelona or Juventus in this leg?
I think maybe Hart says Juventus in this one. I think the maybe the thing that will hold Juventus back is they're they want to control games, and actually what Barcelona try and do is implement elements of chaos which are going to get behind that back line. I still think Max Allegri's control of a game and control of a side is fantastic, but I just wonder whether after what happened in the previous leg between Barcelona and PSG, Barcelona will just think, well, you know, if we score more than two, then we've got the beating of this team. They very often almost hold back out on the pitch from attacking this Juventus side. They just want to control and sort of not strangle a game, but sort of basically just win it in a very almost at a canter when they need to. I'd like to see him unleash a few players out there. I'm going to be very interested to see what Kadira does against this midfield without Busquets in there. It'll be really fascinating.
Also, on Tuesday evening, we've got Borussia Dortmund hosting Monaco. Chris, Monaco 3 points clear at the top of Liga and at the moment, becoming the first side to progress in a Champions League knockout tie after conceding 6 goals following their win in the tie over Manchester City. Dortmund, though, coming off the back of a 4-1 defeat to Bayern Munich at the weekend, and there's injury concerns there for Thomas Tuchel. Marco Reus, a doubt. Shinji Kagawa, a doubt. Julian Weigl, perhaps most significantly, a doubt, you know?
It's not ideal for for Dortmund at all, and yet Lequipe ran will be running a really cool front page on Tuesday of Falcao and the yellow wall, suggesting that it's going to be a really tough game for Monaco. I do like Monaco this season in the Champions League. There's something about them. They've got that sort of air of the year that they made the final. It's a team that has its weaknesses, of course. I think when it comes to game management, specifically how they handle the pace of a game, I think sometimes they get a little bit sucked into either trying to mirror the pace of faster teams or try and go 10% above, which, as we saw with City, meant that they were pretty gassed after about 60-70 minutes of the first leg. But I think that their ability to sort of kill you in a lot of different ways, whether it's Lamar or Mbappe, even Falcao, that's their greatest strength, is their adaptability as a team in the final third. Even their defence, I think, is actually quite strong when it needs to be. It's not perfect, of course, but I think they'll cause Dortmund a lot of problems. And I think, personally, if I'm picking a game to watch on that Tuesday night, it's got to be that Monaco team.
And who are you going for to come out of this one, this first leg, at least, with the win?
I feel like Monaco might nick it 2-0 or 2-1.
Couple of those away goals, nice. Lawrence, are you backing?
I'll go Monaco as well. You can't really quite look beyond
I think I'm going to go for Monaco as well. Is it a clean sweep, Dave?
No, I think it's going to be a 4-3 Borussia Dortmund win.
Going to
be a high scorer.
I love it.
In the first
Monaco
leg,
Monaco are going to beat them at home, but there's going to be so many goals in the game. Both teams are so attacking. Neither team can defend at moments, so I think there's just going to be goals galore.
Will there be goals galore in Madrid, though, Dave? Leicester heading to the Spanish capital to take on Atletico Madrid. Leicester obviously looking to keep that fairy tale alive against a side, though, who are one of the best sides in the competition in recent years, of course, reaching 2 out of the last 3 finals.
Well, yeah, with Antoine Griezmann, they've got a striker that is banging form in 2017, but also in the Champions League in the last 2 seasons, only Messi and Ronaldo have scored more goals than him. But in terms of you look at the players they've got out as well, Kevin Gamero, who had started to have a really good relationship with Griezmann against Leverkusen, and someone like Veselko as well at right fullback, had in fact got the jersey ahead of Juan Fran. And we had a really good relationship with Koke out there. Koke's now been moved to the left-hand side. I feel like Atletico need to get their balance right, but I think they're going to blow Leicester City away. Leicester City have done well to come this far, but this is it. This is too far for them, to be quite honest. Atletico Madrid have got far too much for them to go.
A step too far, Chris?
Yeah, I think so.
Resounding yeah from Chris Lawrence. You agreeing with that?
I think it seems very obvious to say, but the lessons learned from the previous leg by that Sevilla team may prove very important for this Atletico side. The fact is also that they are a little too far behind in the league.
Yeah, I think I'm going to back Atletico for this one as well. Hard to look past them. Perhaps harder to pick a winner is the big one. The big, big game on Wednesday evening. Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid. Two titans of the competition, Chris. Going to be interesting to see how these teams line up. I mean, both of them missing key players in defence. Mats Hummels, potentially out for the rest of the season with an ankle injury. And Pepe as well, being ruled out after breaking his ribs at the weekend. How do you think this one's going to go?
It's an interesting one. I think in a lot of ways you could argue it comes down to who do you think will be the bigger miss, Mats Hummels or Pepe. I think Bayern of late, from when I've seen them, have been fantastic. Ribery and Robin, which I wish I had intended to do, but actually it was just poor pronunciation. Been genuinely fantastic of late. Actually, I just read a really good piece from our friend Andy Brassel today on that, about how they've kind of wound the clock back a little bit. And I find it funny to hear Robin say that his famous cutting inside move that everyone, you know, tags him for, that if it still works, then why does he need to change it? Because I think that's a great ethos to have. I've got a sneaking suspicion that actually this will end up being a draw. They are very close. There's something inside me saying Madrid might sneak it, but I think Bayern are a good side at home, and for that reason, I'm inclined to think it'll be a draw.
Score draw?
Yeah.
Is that a way goal?
Score draw. I reckon Bayern Munich are going to win this one. I think they've got it in their locker. Ooh. Lawrence, what are you saying?
You know what? I'll back Bayern on this one as well. I'm going to go 2-1 Bayern.
Oh, I like it. You back in Bayern, Dave?
But it's still that away. It's still that away goal, mate.
Yeah, I'm going to back Bayern 100%. And they're going to win 3-0.
Wow, I guess.
Thiago is going to be absolutely instrumental in this demolition of Real Madrid. Zinedine Zidane versus his teacher. He's going to bottle it.
Ooh, tasty. A tasty little subplot there. A tasty subplot as well in this midweek. Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi vying to become the first players to score 100 goals in the competition. Ronaldo, I believe, on 98, Messi on 97. So that could be an interesting one to keep an eye on if you're a Messi/Ronaldo fan/watcher. Anyway, guys, fantastic stuff. Thanks for listening. That is Monday's podcast done. Until Thursday, when we'll be reviewing and no doubt talking about our terrible, terrible predictions on this Champions League week. Chris, where can the listeners find you?
At the front three.
Oh, good.
Dave?
In bed, suffering.
Yeah, resting up, recovering. 2 miles. Yeah, I like that. I like that. Lawrence?
In the Twitter. At the front three, just go and find it. It's
in
great.
The Thrilled Twitter, it. Yeah, I'd recommend that. The front
three. I am hashtag. I'm
yeah,
the whole,
some yeah. great. I'm reluctant to use the word banter with a straight face, but some very amusing tweets this week, especially tonight from Chris mainly.
Poor Arsenal.
Let's not feel too sorry for him. We don't have a lot of sympathy.
Poor Robbie.
Robbie's having a great time, mate. Robbie knows what he's doing.
Do you think Robbie would exchange all the views on Arsenal Fan TV if they could win the title?
No, because it's about giving fans a voice.
Yeah. Good point.
There's more. There's bigger goals, Lawrence. There's bigger things in life than winning trophies, you know.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
On that note, guys, thank you so much for listening. We will see you on Thursday. Enjoy the Champions League. I know we will.